Welcome to Kenyatta's Talent Hunt. Our host, Kenyatta Uzel, founder and CEO of PolyHire, talks with business leaders about what has elevated their careers. PolyHire has a long-standing track record of successfully recruiting top professionals to enhance the quality of life for all citizens, constituents, and customers. Kenyatta's Talent Hunt does a deep dive into how candidates reach the top of the selection process, examining everything from their education and backgrounds to their work experience and personal style. Kenyatta's guests share key and compelling aspects of their career climbs and give listeners an intimate peek behind the curtain of what it takes to create a leader. Kenyatta's Talent Hunt starts now.
Hello, everyone. I'm sitting here today with General Retired William Kip Ward, who many of you know from his time as head of AFRICOM. Particularly special now, given all the challenges that are happening around the world. But what you don't know, and while I'm really excited to be sitting here, is that this happens to be my father-in-law, who I will refer to as Kip. Kip has a lot to share, and I can unlock a lot of things that you might not know about how he came to a lifetime of service and how he lives his value system every single day. Hope you will find this conversation incredibly useful as you seek new opportunities for yourself and to build your organizations. After two decades of serving as the leader of PolyHire, an executive search firm placing and training those who choose to serve, today marks the start of what I hope are many compelling conversations about leadership, service, recruitment, and retention for people that dedicated their lives to serving. Kip Ward was the first commander of U.S. AFRICOM. As the inaugural commander of the United States Africa Command, Kip successfully established the nation's newest and uniquely positioned interagency combat command responsible for all U.S. defense and security activities on the African continent and its island nations with staff representatives from state, commerce, treasury, homeland security, and other U.S. cabinet departments and agencies. Before commanding AFRICOM, General Ward was the deputy commander of the United States European Command, Germany. While serving as deputy commanding general and chief of staff, U.S. Army Europe and 7th Army in 2005, General Ward was selected by the U.S. Secretary of State to serve as United States Security Coordinator, Israel-Palestinian Authority in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. Welcome, General Ward, or as I refer to as Kip.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be a part of this conversation with you, Kenyatta.
Well, look, what we want to start with, I believe, is your tenure with AFRICOM. Tell us a little bit about what AFRICOM is and your leadership there, how you were appointed leadership, and what they do there. What is AFRICOM?
AFRICOM is our nation's newest geographic command within the Department of Defense. It was established as a result of previously having had three different combatant commands responsible for the work that's done by the Defense Department on the continent of Africa. That work was being done by U.S. European Command, U.S. Central Command, and U.S. Indo-Pacific Command. And the decision was made in the 2006-2007 timeframe that given the importance of the continent, the clarity of the mission would be better advanced through a single command as opposed to having it being done by three separate commands. So the synergy, the cohesiveness that was presented, that presented itself because of a single combatant command was the impetus behind creating AFRICOM. And I was privileged to be appointed by the President of the United States and confirmed by the Senate to be the inaugural commander of the United States Africa Command, responsible for all the Department of Defense activities on the continent of Africa and its island nations, the Indian Ocean island nations of the continent.
Well, let me interrupt you there. There's something else that I believe is quite important and a milestone is you being appointed to that role. Speak a little bit about what that key piece is, kind of a barrier breaker there.
Well, when AFRICOM was established, the services all recommend and submit their nominees to be the combatant commander. The United States Army submitted my name as the first commander. And when President of the United States appointed me, and that appointment was confirmed by the U.S. Senate, thus I became the nation's first Black combatant commander. And that was done as I was named to head the United States Africa Command. So in 2007, when that command was created and set apart, I was its first commander. And as such, I became the first Black combatant commander in the United States.
Congratulations. That is quite notable and didn't want to leave that out by any means. So tell us how you found yourself there.
After going to AFRICOM, it was a culmination for me of over 35 years of service and having commanded multiple formations at Echelon and having done many, many things with respect to my interactions around the world, the combatant command position is one that is pretty unique. We work with the diplomats of our nation. We work with the heads of state of other nations. We work with their militaries. And the experiences that I had amassed over 3 decades of service were the types of things that were important for how I then found myself in that position to be someone with the background, the experiences that made my appointment and confirmation something that was looked upon as the best thing to do.
Well, speaking of that background and all that you've done, one would be led to believe that maybe you are a graduate of an academy. But how did a boy from Baltimore, Maryland, end up leading AFRICOM?
It's a long road. And if someone had asked me at that point in time that what eventually happened would have happened, I would have looked at them as if they had horns coming out of their head. Because you don't envision in 1967, when I graduated from high school, that over 40 years later, I would be commanding a combatant command. In 1967, we were in the middle of Vietnam. There was a draft going on. And having graduated from high school, my parents decided that, hey, you're going to go to college. I was from Baltimore. And although there were options, the period that we were in, going to Morgan State, then college in Baltimore was an option that made most sense to me and those who were influences for me. It's no shame in me in saying that I didn't get a lot of support from counselors at the high school I graduated from the standpoint of offering possibilities, offering alternatives. In fact, didn't receive very much from any counselor with respect to going to higher education, but it was my family, my parents, my aunt who had been a Morgan graduate, my mother's youngest sister that said, well, Morgan is the school. And so we find ourselves going to college in the middle of Vietnam, middle of a draft. And in order not to be drafted, we had to be in a program that gave us an exemption. And at Morgan State, as with many other state universities, things like Texas A&M, other state schools, during those years, ROTC was mandatory for male students. Now, the mandatory period was for 2 years. 2 years of service, and then you could go on with your education. But if you decided not to enroll in ROTC for the third and fourth year, you could be drafted. So in 1969, when my first 2 years were out, my father, who had been a World War II veteran, said, well, if you're going to go into the Army or go into service in Vietnam, draft is going on, go as an officer. So I stayed in ROTC for those final 2 years. I received an ROTC scholarship. And when I graduated from Morgan in 1971, I was a distinguished military graduate as well as a political science major, and I was commissioned in the regular Army of the United States as an infantryman on the 6th of June, 1961, a pretty special date, the 6th of June. As you know, 6th of June is also D-Day. And so that is how my career began and why I stayed in the military, because of not just the situation of the day, but things that were going on and the desire and also the drive and the push by those who knew me and loved me, say, well, if you're going to go into the Army, go as an officer. And my dad, having been a non-commissioned officer in World War II, his vision for who I could be was something beyond what I saw for myself at the time.
Well, that's what I wanted to pivot to. I wanted to talk a little bit more about that influence, your parents, your father in particular, and that his influence on you and enlisting in public service, and or not enlisting, but going into public service. Talk a little bit about your upbringing.
Well, one of the things about my dad and my mom, but was that, you know, I saw them treat people with respect, and especially my dad. He was someone who I would go be with him as he was doing one his regular job, but all the other things that he would always do for other people. He was, as I said, a World War II veteran out of the Second World War. And using the GI Bill, he was able to amass a few skills. He didn't take advantage of all the opportunities that were available to him. And many of the opportunities weren't even told to him during those years, but he did take advantage of some of them. And he did a lot of odd jobs in addition to his profession. So I would watch my father do things for other people in ways that always demonstrated how he respected people. And so for me, something that I learned from him, the values that I had, you just treat people with respect and dignity. It doesn't matter who they are, what they do, what their station in life is, but you treat everyone with respect and dignity because every person has value. Their life has value. And so I was very much influenced by watching him interact with others. My mom, a daughter of a minister, again, having values, integrity, honesty, doing the right thing. I looked at that and I saw that, and those sort of things were embodied in me as well. You know, the character that I saw, they persevered. My mom and my dad built the home that we lived in. The small area community in Baltimore where I grew up was eventually torn down to make room for development in Baltimore. And when that occurred, my father and mother made a decision that they would build their own home. Didn't get the type of loans that they wanted. So what happened over the course of time, they built that home, and it was built over a period of 6 years. But at the conclusion of it, we moved in and they had no debt, had no mortgage because they paid for it as they went along. So I watched them and how they persevered with that. And it was those things, sticking to something, being committed to something, treating people with dignity and respect, having values that made sense for who you were, where you were. Those are all characteristics that I watched and observed as I was a youngster growing up and that I saw being exemplified by the behavior and character of my parents.
Well, great. Those things lead right into what our podcast really is. And it's about leadership. And you mentioned something that separates what a great leader is, and that's character. You use the words integrity and character. Those are two very important pieces of leadership. Let's talk a little bit about your leadership. So you're commissioned in as a second lieutenant, and you quickly rise through the ranks to ascending to a commander of combatant command. Tell us a little bit about your journey to where you eventually ascended and how you got there, and what others can learn from some of the adventures and things you had while you were climbing that ladder in the military, those 40 years or so, those four decades.
Right. Well, that's right. So I don't know how quick it was. It took four decades. It was over a period of time. It was over a period of time of doing things, being responsible for things. I was blessed that when I graduated from Morgan, I was commissioned and I came on active duty immediately. And being on active duty as an infantry lieutenant, that meant I was in charge of a platoon. So I had 35 soldiers that worked for me. Now, that didn't mean that I knew everything. I had to rely on others to help me with my understanding of this new thing called the Army. And although I've been in ROTC and had certainly learned basic aspects of being a military officer, the experience factor was the next piece of it. So who I was with, my non-commissioned officers, those sergeants, my senior officers that were part of the unit that I was in, you know, listening to them, understanding what was being done by them, but importantly, continuing to work to learn all that I could learn about the job that I was going to do. And one of the things about any leader is you have to know your job. You have to know what you're doing. Sometimes a job that you get assigned isn't a job that you may want to do, but my thought was that any job that I'm going to do, I'm going to do it the very best so that when I leave that job, no one can say that, hey, Ward didn't know what he was doing in that position. And that's a combination of things that I would learn because I'd studied on my own, but also things that I would learn because I would listen to those who understood what the job was so that I could gain from them from those things that were important to me in doing that job.
You are listening to Kenyatta's Talent Hunt, where business leaders share their experiences and lessons learned in their personal and professional journeys. Now back to Kenyatta's Talent Hunt.
Of all of the places you've been and the work you've done, is there one outside of AFRICOM that you feel would be, I wouldn't call it monumental because you've done quite a bit, and one that stands out more than others and could provide information and education on those who are aspiring to continue to grow in leadership? The most complex, most monumental. What would you, if you had to identify one or two?
Yeah, well, the good news is you take every assignment you have and you build upon it. You don't know going into an assignment the totality of all that it is, unless you've done something over and over and over again. But in those cases, you can become a bit narrow in what you do. For me, I had the privilege of leading and commanding at echelon, meaning at every level in the Army, as a platoon leader, as a company commander. I've had in my company 160 people that were under my command. As a battalion commander, almost 700 people in my command. As a brigade commander, almost 3,000 people in my command. As a division commander, 20,000 people in my command. And the beauty of command is that you can face all the complexities of leading people, of understanding who your people are, of developing staffs, because as you get in larger and larger organizations, you can't do it all yourself. You have to rely on others to support the mission that's at hand in order to have it accomplished in a way that makes sense. And for me, how we did that and how you look at the mission, the people that you have, how you take advantage of their talents so that as a leader, you can then ensure that the job that's being done by every member of your command, you have personally looked at those individuals or those who are subordinate leaders have been given the type of direction, the vision, the intent of you as the commander, such that the mission is being executed in a way that's satisfactory and really being executed with excellence to the very best you can. For me, my command positions were always the ones that I enjoyed the most because I'm with people. But these other staff positions were also very critically important because in those staff positions, you learned procedures, processes, the things that you need to do to make things happen, how things are enabled such that the mission can be done because you can't do it all yourself. Any leader that thinks he or she can do it all by himself or herself, that is absolutely, you rely on a team. And building teams is so critically important in getting a job done. Teams that are staffed by competent people who, one, understand what your intent is as a leader, what your vision is, and how they fit into making that happen. And one of my driving philosophies was that as a teammate, you're doing what you do, not because you're elevating yourself, but you're doing what you do because you're elevating others. And if every member of the team is working to elevate their teammate, then the whole team is being lifted. And so it's not that you're in competition with your teammate, you're supporting your teammate. And as a leader, how you inculcate that attitude is so critically important in getting the job done, and especially in a sustained way. You know, anyone can, as I call it, can get stupid and be a screamer, a yeller, and make something happen. But if you want something to happen in a sustained way over time, you want your teammates, those that you're leading, to be doing what they do because they want to ensure the success of the organization.
I don't want to gloss over by any means that, you know, you were appointed by the president and the U.S. Secretary of State in 2005 to serve as the United States Security Coordinator for Israel-Palestinian Authority in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. Hot button areas right now. What key pieces do leaders like you look at in identifying those who help you lead and fulfill the mission? And are those the same qualities and characteristics that you look for as a corporate leader where you are president of Centel Corporation here in Alexandria, Virginia? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, there are some similarities, but there are also some differences. Obviously, in the military, when it comes to the essence of the mission, it's about saving lives. You know, women and men die if the mission isn't accomplished in satisfactory ways. In the corporate world, clearly, you know, the profit piece is there. That's clearly important because people are dependent upon what they do in order to pay mortgages, to have insurances, to send children to school. So clearly important work there as well. But a bit of a distinction because in military, it's life or death. But regardless, the things that you look for in your people, there are great similarities. Can someone do the job? And you don't know that unless you build some type of relationship. You know, you understand. You have to have some insight into who that individual is as a person. Because as a leader, you want to ensure that you're getting the best performance out of your talent. And sometimes you don't know that, but so you have to do things based on what were they doing before? How did they do that before? What sort of results did they have? what is their reputation as a person to get a job done. You have some basic understanding going into it. Sometimes you learn it when you're thrust together. You may go into it blind, but you take some time to observe and you understand what it is that they have to do. And then you make a determination. Is my assessment of this individual such that the job that they have, based on my assessment, be it a lengthy assessment, sometimes being on a short truncated assessment, can they get the job done? And then you observe and you pay attention, you understand what they're doing, and you do the best you can to understand their value add to that particular job and how well it's being done. You take feedback from other members because you also listen to what others on the team are not just saying, but the reaction you observe is the relationship that's being formed by that person and the other teammates. Is it working? Is it not working? And as a leader, you have to have, I'd say, your antenna out, not literally, but understanding what's happening in the organization so that you have a sense of what this person is, what they're doing, how they're doing it. And those who do it well, you continue to capitalize on that. Those that need additional training or emphasis or some additional instruction, then you do that as well. But a leader has to understand that. And again, the larger the organization you're in, you can't do it all personally. So you rely on others that you do have that confidence and faith in to do those sorts of things for you so that they then can provide the feedback to you, the information that you then would require to continue to make those sorts of assessments that lead to the success of your organization. And as the Vice J3 of the Joint Staff, as an example, the Vice J3, I'm the operations on 9/11 there in the Pentagon. I was responsible for ensuring that the deployment of U.S. forces around the world, be it the Air Force, Army, Navy, Marine Corps, that when the Secretary of Defense decided to employ or deploy forces around the world, who those forces were. So coordinating with all the services so that we understood who was ready, what type of training patterns were units in, so that when a mission was given and there was a requirement for a force to be deployed globally, then we were doing that. And certainly when this nation was attacked on 9/11, with the Twin Towers in New York, with the attack on the Pentagon, as well as with the aircraft that was forced down in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, we didn't know what was really happening. So we had to do the things that prepared us for the best as we could be prepared for whatever alternatives would be coming. So it was shutting down airspace, protecting critical infrastructure, orchestrating those things with the Federal Aviation Administration, with the North American Air Defense Command. Those were the things that I was doing as the Vice Director for Operations on the Joint Staff to J3 then. And I was doing that through my Joint Staff Directorates and those other members of the J3 that were responsible for helping us coordinate with all those entities.
I don't think any of us can imagine what it was like in the Pentagon during that time. But with the group of leaders that you'd assembled that reported to you and that had been assembled by the president and other leadership within the country, there's obviously conflict that takes place, varying ideas, personalities that don't mesh. Talk a little bit about conflict management and your thoughts on that and your experiences along the way in being able to resolve some of those.
Yeah, I think I'd put it in a little bit a different place. You know, conflict, when I think about conflict, I think of folks going to battle. And then on a team, I don't need folks going to battle on a team. What I do want on a team are things that present alternatives, the things that present differences, things that present an alternative approach to doing something, because there are better ways. And you don't need to be the only one making decisions on how something is going to be done. You need folks to provide you with feedback, input that can help you make the best decision. And sometimes, even though you may be the leader, sometimes your thought, you might miss something. That's why for me, diversity is important. You want diverse thought. And so I would kind of term it out or term it as, instead of just conflict, how do you have healthy friction, and how do you deal with healthy friction in an organization? And friction doesn't necessarily not bad. When I was stationed in Alaska, having friction with your car tires on the ice was a good thing. You want right. to be able to go. There's right. no friction. You're spinning your wheels. So a little bit of friction is okay, but friction that's not disruptive, because if it's disruptive, then you aren't going anywhere. So
how do you nurture and manage that? That's I believe that's the key is if there is good friction, but there are inevitably times you're going to have folks who just don't work well together. And you know they both have high potential.
Yeah, yeah. Well, first thing that you do is you have a dialogue. I mean, there's dialogue, your discussion. You want ideas brought to you. You don't want to have only people that will give you the answer that they think you want. You want to have that difference. But it comes to a point when you as a leader, once the decision is made, the expectation is that everyone is moving ahead to execute, to carry out, to implement the decision then. And you want them to be implementing it as if it were their own. And quite frankly, if someone can't do that, then maybe they're just not a member of your team. But it doesn't happen because you have summarily said, hey, I don't want to hear what you said, because you want those ideas. And one of the things that the military taught me was that up until the time that the decision is made, I want all the feedback I can receive from the various corners of the organization, so that when I make the decision, when the decision is made, it is taken into account those things that have been brought forward. And you want to listen to those, and you want people that you have that are free to present those to you. But again, you get to a point, okay, yes, I heard what you said, I understand it, but this is the decision. And the expectation is that once that decision is made, everyone is moving ahead in a way that the execution as if they made the decision. And candidly, if you can't have that, and if you can't do that, and if someone can't support that, then maybe that's a time when that particular individual or person, hey, okay, well, then can't have you on this team. But it's not because I didn't want to listen to you. I did, but you can't carry the decision out to make the mission successful.
You talk about, you know, building these teams. One of the things that I know you're very passionate about, and you spend quite a bit of time outside of your professional day-to-day, I believe it's part of your life now, is mentorship and is building leaders and grooming that next generation of leaders. Two-part question here. What advice would you give those aspiring public leaders, those that want to serve, those that have a spirit of service? What advice would you give those individuals? And talk a little bit about mentorship and where that plays into all of that and growing and developing those that aspire to be, you know, the chief, the most senior leader or senior leadership.
One of the first things for me that whoever you're with has to know is that, you know, they care about you, that you matter to them. And when it comes to mentoring, it's a relationship, candidly, that's give and take relationship. You know, the mentoring can go both ways, because as a mentor, you have experienced things that the mentee has not. And so therefore, providing your example, your experiences, provides the person being mentored something that they can use, put in their, as I say, put in their kit bag, so that if that experience comes in front of them, they have some perspective of how they might deal with it. They have some perspective of what might be coming down the road, if you will, based on what they're doing, so that when something happens, it's not going to be the first time and they don't know what to do with it. This includes the positive as well as the negative things, because not all things will happen in an organization that are rosy. And so when these negative things happen, as they invariably will, how do you deal with that? Do you go off the rail and dig the hole deeper, or do you respond to it in a way, okay, this has happened, but if I react or respond in a certain way, I have an ability to recover and respond from this. And so as a mentor, you provide the person that you're mentoring with these sorts of examples. And one of the big things is the person that you're mentoring, are they receiving it? Right. I mean, are they, that doesn't matter to them, you know? So those who express a desire to understand from you is one of the key things in determining who that you're mentoring. But another key thing is to sometimes seeing something in a person beyond what they may see in themselves. And the responsibility that you have as someone who cares about them, to in spite of themselves, I'm going to do my best to provide you with the sort of data points, the information, the experiences that will enable you to be more successful than who you even think that you might be at this point in time. Because in 5 years, 10 years, you'll say, yeah, what Ward said to me, I didn't get then, but I get now, and I'm sure glad that he didn't or she didn't give up on me. And so as a mentor, you see this beyond the person that you're talking to. And there are also times when the person that's doing the mentoring will see something from someone that they are mentoring. They say, wow, what that young woman or young man just said makes all kinds of difference to me. And they even take it and it's becomes a growth thing for them as well, because none of us is ever too old to continue to learn. Learning is a daily experience. I use a saying, every day you work to improve the foxhole. You work to make what you are where you are better. And when you stop growing and you stop learning, then you probably stop being as effective as you could be. And so this notion of mentoring works both ways. And a mentor provides the best that he or she can provide to cause the person being mentored. And it has nothing to do with chronological age. It does have something to do with experience. What have you experienced that the person that you're mentoring has not experienced? And you convey that to the person in hopes that it will cause their journey to be not just smoother, but at least successful, because that's what you want. Because all journeys aren't smooth, but they can all be successful as long as you react to them and move forward with them in ways that helps to ensure that success.
Absolutely. And one of the important pieces that I ask of each of the individuals that we assess, as we assess talent at PolyHire to assist our clients in identifying strong leaders, is who is your mentor? Tell me a little bit about those you mentor. You can tell a lot about an individual and their aptitude in leadership if they are receptive and if they are active participants in making certain that they are continuing to keep the pipeline full of our public servants. I think of the number of city administrators and police chiefs and county executives and county administrators around the country that have we've placed through PolyHire. And I can easily name a number of them who can talk about volumes, speak volumes about those that that they look to as mentors and how they are now leading some of the larger jurisdictions and some of the smaller jurisdictions around the country. So that's very important. And again, I know your work. We continue to watch your work in mentorship and the young folks that you work with in your community where you live, as well as in Washington, D.C. I know there's a school there, too, that you do quite a bit of mentorship. So very important in as a leader to give back. And that is a key characteristic of leadership. Talk a little bit about or leave us with something that our aspiring leaders should take to heart.
Well, you know, in today's environment, there are a couple of things that I think are critically important in leaders. I was at an event in Dover, Delaware earlier this fall, and I was with a group of political appointees as well as some elected officials. And we were talking about this very topic, you know, leadership. And what is the common thing that's so critically important in leadership? Now, as a young Army officer, I took an oath of office. And that oath caused me to pledge my loyalty to an ideal, not an individual, not a person, not a party, but to an ideal, and an ideal that was spelled out in our Constitution. Most officials who are in the public sphere take an oath of office. You know, mayors, governors, other public officials, be it the state, municipal, they take an oath of office. Every promotion that I received, I would repeat that oath when I was voted to lieutenant, first lieutenant, to major, to lieutenant colonel, to colonel. And every promotion as a general, 1, 2, 3, and 4 star, that oath was repeated. So you take an oath, and that oath is to an ideal. And so for me, when you look at what goes on in any organization, and especially the work that's done with by PolyHire and others that are public-facing organizations, that oath that you take says that I am doing what I do, and certainly I want to be able to feed my family and clothe my family and send my children to school and have a decent place to live. But you are serving others. You're serving others. There is an old Stivers print that I kept many Stivers prints. And there's one, Don Stivers, the artist, that's one that has a Buffalo soldier standing by his mount, you know, his horse. And it says, proud to serve. And that for me was my approach. I was proud to serve, and I would go into an organization, and even as a leader, I would tell my team, you know, I'm not here for you to serve me. I'm here to serve you, to do my best to ensure that as you do what you do, all that I can do to cause you to be successful and effective in your job, that's what I'm doing. And so when it comes to the work that's done in the public sphere, or even in the private sphere, What is the mentality? What is the attitude? What is the character that says, what I do to achieve the best result for me is totally wrapped up in what I'm doing to serve you to the very best of my ability. And we have different levels, if you will, different responsibilities. But in each case, that service is being provided. Are you doing it for the good of the organization? So that for the good of your teammates, so that whatever you do, you're impacting them in a positive way. I would often use a scenario that would say, what have you done today to make your teammates' job more effective or easier, to facilitate them doing what they do? And if we all do that, then the entire team gets lifted. So this notion of serving service to a cause that's greater than just you, yeah, you want to be able to take care of yourself, to be sure. But that, if that's the primacy of what you're doing, and that's the primary focus that you have, then it might be a little bit misguided, because then your teammates will say, wow, all that person cares about is himself or herself. But how is what you're doing also empowering, enabling those who you serve with to be better, to help realize themselves in a more effective way? And if we all do that for one another, the power of that is immeasurable. And so I think the notion of service to something, a cause beyond who you are, is where we all would want to be to make a difference.
General Ward, I thank you, and thank you for your service.
Thank you very much. Proud to serve.
So happy that you tuned in today. Over the coming weeks and months ahead, my colleagues and I hope to bring you a wide range of guests and perspectives on recruiting, interviewing, hiring, retention, the challenges and opportunities in leadership from a wide range of guests who've dedicated their lives to service. Beyond the professional, we hope to shine a light on going from special candidate to visionary leader. Please tune in again.
You've been listening to Kenyatta's Talent Hunt with our host, Kenyatta Uzel, founder and CEO of PolyHire. We'll see you next time on Kenyatta's Talent Hunt.